The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
The Social Democrats are proposing knife surrender bins as part of their Tackling Violence in Dublin City plan. I'm joined on the line now by Gary Gannon, Dublin Central TD and Justice Spokesperson for the Social Democrats. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, how will this proposal of yours work and what's the detail?
So, Pat, how often do we hear a person, a guard or a politician coming onto a show like yours after an incident, a violent incident in town, and saying, we can't police our way out of this? So what we're doing today in the Social Democrats to try bring the conversation beyond where Jim McAllen seems to want it is to propose a health-led approach to violence reduction. And I know some of your listeners might roll their eyes at the idea of a health-led approach. But if you think of all the factors that make the city unsafe, I mean, you're going to have people wandering around in states of addiction. There is very clearly a mental health crisis within Dublin and within Ireland. That contributes to a sense where the city is feeling unsafe. There's a huge level of homelessness. There are young people without question going around on scooters, all making the city unsafe. So we're approaching this from a multitude of different angles. Look, we want to see a safety audit of places where the proliferation of homeless accommodation and hostels, because inevitably, Pat, some of those places are very deteriorating to the person. And we see the outcomes of that. So why isn't the HSE doing follow-up supports within there very early? Look, inevitably, we are going to come into areas like sentencing, which comes up constantly in terms of why is this person out after having 50 convictions or why is this person back on the street? Well, in the first instance, before we get to any of that, why don't we try a different approach? And actually, in the first instance, if a person's convicted of a crime that's not violent, that cannot be a violent crime, why don't we have a form of sentencing in the community, a JLO, which has been proven to be very effective, better resourcing of that, and actually a range of different modules that actually approach violence, the causes of violence, from a health-led approach. Right. And I do think, I can understand why your listeners would just think, why don't we just lock them all up? We've tried that, it isn't working.
Also, we don't have the room, Gary, to be frank. I mean, that's why we have a revolving door, because this morning even there are stories of gross overcrowding in prisons, which is unsafe. Not alone is it unsafe, it's unkind and it's cruel.
It's unsafe, it's unkind and it's cruel, and there's absolutely no evidence that it works. Look, what I want to see is somebody who lives in the city centre. I want to see a reduction of the type of things that make our city unsafe. Most prominent of all in that is the violence. I think there's a role for the HSE. There's very clearly a role for Dublin City Council. Look, the streets look unsafe. If you have a look at the UN Safer City for Women and Young Girls initiative that we actually signed up to in 2015, it was about confronting dereliction, improving street lighting, getting the aesthetic of the city correct. Look, it might seem like a small thing that doesn't, but those things lead to violence. We all know the broken windows theory and all of that. Yeah. I mean, that's long established. So why don't we approach it from different angles? Look, I've been kind of surprised by Jim McAllen, the new minister Jim McAllen's approach to violence over the last 2 weeks. He seems to be a commentator after the fact. And he's talked about increased sentences, which we know went up from 5 to 7 years last year for possession of a knife. We know that violence assaults went up from 5 years to 10 years. But we also know that that's just increasing sentences. That's not reducing violence. That is not evidence. We have models in Scotland, for example, the No Knives, Better Lives approach, when they had a kind of an outbreak of violence.
So Gary, let's start at the very base thing. Why do people carry knives? And, you know, on one level, you can say someone who's in and out of a hostel, for example, feels unsafe in that hostel for all sorts of reasons and literally carries a knife to protect himself. That's one category. And then there are young lads going around with knives for no apparent reason except to do others harm.
So, and I know it's very difficult to see this from the idea of a potential perpetrator. I mean, but the reason people are carrying knives, be it the fella in the hostel accommodation or the young lads on the street, it all in its essence comes down to fear. They're carrying them. This is a kind of, it's a horrible phrase, but it's an arms race. They're carrying them because they believe other people have them. And they're scared, they're terrified. And what they do with that fear is turn it into a really dastardly way. So, I mean, addressing that early. So there's two approaches and there's two different things. I would separate the guy in the hostel from the young people in town. They need violence interventionists. They need people who they probably have looked up 10, 15 years ago who probably wouldn't have been in violence themselves to go into where we find these kids. If it's in school, fine. If it's in kind of the youth reaches or the centres of early school leaving, get in there and talk to them on a peer mentor level. Actually talk about the causes of violence and talk about the harm it's done. Let them meet some victims of knife crime. I mean, this is a model that actually has worked. When you actually open the conversation to a person who may be about to take a knife into their hand and show them the consequences that somebody else or maybe they will receive in the future, that's been proven to work.
Now, the question of whether, you know, you talk to someone in a school or in some other setting and you talk sense into them, but that person in their recreational time, in their downtime, these are people who are maybe addicted or drunk a lot of the time, when all sense goes out the window.
This is it. So, I mean, I'd separate kind of going into the schools and the youth reaches and places like that with kind of a peer-led approach from what the HSE need to do in terms of going into the hostel and homeless accommodations that are proliferating all over the city. I mean, the HSE need to do very intensive mental health audits and then support in those facilities. Because, I mean, I've been in a couple of them. I can't imagine living my life in terms of in rooms where usually there are people drinking, there are people taking drugs. You're just bouncing off the walls. And if you're going in there with poor mental health as it is, that is increasingly going to be getting worse. There are some of these centres that actually force people out onto the street in the morning, don't let them back in until the late evening. So all of that just creates an environment where that person is obviously starting to feel unsafe, starting to feel...
But Gary, what about the others? The young guys who are going out there coked up and they've got a knife on their person, their ability to make that sensible decision that would be advocated in the schools or in other settings is just not there when they're coked up.
And without a shadow of a doubt, that's when we need a stronger Garda presence in the city. I mean, I listened to the Assistant Commissioner, Paul Cleary, who's writing in the Times over the weekend. He has a very comprehensive outline for a Garda-based policing approach in the city centre. I mean, he talked about using data, having more guards at points where these young people are more likely to congregate, intervening quickly. I think that's all very well. I think that's good, and I hope it works if it's resourced by the state.
He also wants guards who have come from those very communities to, you know, he wants to recruit people into the Garda Síochána. But you wonder whether the kind of barriers that are to entering the Garda Síochána are such that he's not going to get that kind of recruitment.
Yeah, Pat, I mean, over the last couple of years, particularly, like I've seen in the North Dinner City, actually know a couple of lads from Finglas. I do know a lot of lads from working class areas that have gone into the Guards over the last 10, 15 years. I think a lot of that kind of the void that we would have had has kind of broken down. The problem with becoming a guard in the city centre, you can't afford to actually live anywhere. I mean, a guard on probation starting off is earning about 32,000 a year. That's not going to get you anywhere near an apartment in the city centre. And then you won't obviously be eligible for social housing. It's like me, that's where you would have grown up. So, I mean, the factors that stop a working class person getting involved in the guards, they're no longer just kind of stigma or anything like that. They're actually more practical. They just can't afford to live in the area where they grew up. So I would love to see more of that. I think there has been improvements, but so the reason why we're not getting guards and guards leaving en masse is you can't afford to actually live in the places we're asking them to police. So Jim O'Callaghan, the young kind of this cheerleader in chief, telling people the guards a great job. I think people know that. It's just not a job they can sustain themselves or a family in.
Now, the question of Jim O'Callaghan talking about stop and search powers, what do you think of that? That if they have a suspicion that a gang of youths may be armed with hidden knives, they can stop them and search them. What do you say?
Yeah. Pat, I'm absolutely, I would be for that type of power, but I also think it requires oversight. And I don't think that's, again, me being a bleeding heart liberal of anything of the sort. I just think good data, good oversight as to kind of what is the approach to take to stop and search, how are people being identified, how is the evidence collated from that stop and search also being kind of publicly available. I just think if we're going to have stop and search, and that is absolutely fine, we've already seen increases of possession of knife, we've seen that. I can accept the fact that it works, but it does not work without oversight. So having a good oversight would actually make that more effective.
Now Gary, the headline grabber from your initiatives, you know, this the subtext is all about health, it's about prevention, but the headline grabber is a knife amnesty and knife bins around the city. How would that actually work?
So it works in a way. So I have had said in police stations, but I mean, the likelihood is that a person's not going to go into a police station and surrender a knife.
No.
Where they work best is if you have them in community centres where people might have had that one good adult. So a young person who's considering getting involved in violence, they got the intervention from the one good adult and they need to get rid of that big blade that they now have stored under their bed. If it's a scenario where they can go in and drop that safely for them and safely for the kind of the community centre, to get that knife out of their hands, because now it's under their bed, now it's always going to be there. They've had the intervention and now we need to take the weapon off them. We need a place where they can do that and where they feel safe to do so. And so that's why a knife surrender bin may seem kind of like an eye-opening approach, but I mean, it's shown to work in different jurisdictions. There's evidence of this in the US with guns. There's evidence in Scotland with knives. So having a surrender place where that young person who went out and bought the knife or stole the knife, has it under their bed, can now realise that this is not the right approach and can actually surrender that knife before the harm is done. Look, it is absolutely a strategy which I appreciate will kind of make listeners take a step back. But when you consider the fact that this takes the knife away from that young person before they get to use it, it's an approach that I think would have more good than harm.
The other thing is about the sale of knives. I mean, obviously, knives that are used for hunting or whatever, those knife sales could be controlled. Go into any major supermarket and there'll be a section in the kitchenware where you can buy a knife. I mean, are we expecting the young, mostly young women behind the till when a young fella comes along with one of these and tries to buy it to say, no, I'm sorry, I have to call my manager?
No, I don't think we're going to get a scenario where every kind of kitchen and upholstery shop in the city is going to be able to not to be able to sell knives for obvious reasons. But I mean, I think when you have intervention approaches from an early age where you're talking to a young person who may actually explain the outcomes of using that knife, how that might be, how they could meet the victim and meet the victim's family. If you have those education programs early, we're not going to be able to stop the selling of knives. But I do think if we provide the information as to the outcome in terms of using that knife, we will likely get better outcomes than what we're presently having. We do have increases of knife violence, but we also need to match that with increases in terms of positive interventions. Look, I'm not against sentencing in any way for a person who engages in that behaviour and harsh sentencing. But what I don't believe for a second is that alone will work. So we need positive health-based interventions to stop a young person or a person who's older from actually using that knife, using that kind of method of violence to address their own fear.
Finally, Gary, I mean, where it has worked, I'm sure you've looked at other jurisdictions, whether it's the health-led approach or whether it's knife amnesties. What are the councils or the police forces in those areas saying about their initiatives, how successful they are?
Yeah, so in Scotland, for example, and in Glasgow in particular, this was something that has like kind of huge success. You'll see that a lot of the politicians pointed to it. The councils have got really great outcomes from it, but it does kind of have to be this holistic approach. So for me, getting the city clean, looking nice, addressing the mental health issues that are proliferating around those hostels and centres of need, and coming at young people from a different angle before they ever get to that violent stage. Look, I think that could give us a much better outcomes, actually more true and real outcomes than what we're being presented with at the moment, where we can just talk about crime after the fact. Crime can actually be reduced. We don't have to feel so scared walking around the city, but we do need short, medium and long-term strategies to address that.
Gary Gannon, Dublin Central TD and Justice Spokesperson for the Social Democrats. Gary, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Pat.
News Talk's Cash Machine.
Down on the farm, James Cunningham was our winner on Friday when he emptied the machine. But the good news is the machine is packed with cash again, and it's a guaranteed winner this coming Friday. €200,000. Think of what that money might mean to you. So to enter, text PLAY to 57557 before 3 on Friday. Then after 3, randomly, we'll make the call. If it's to your phone, answer within 5 rings, tell us the total, and then you get all the money. And if you don't answer, we'll keep dialing until we find our winner. The cost is €2.50 plus your standard message rate, over 18s only. You're playing across the GoLad network of stations. Full terms on newstalk.com. But remember Friday's guaranteed prize, €200,000, and it's tax-free. Text PLAY to 57557. Now, some of the texts coming in on knife crime. A knife amnesty is not going to work. It's ridiculous to even contemplate this notion. We need minimum prison sentences to make some young lads think twice about carrying a knife in the first place. That's from Dave in Dublin. Unfortunately, the lack of deterrence leaves it wide open for undesirable individuals, gangs, etc., to do any crime they like. The Bleeding Hearts will always stick. Sorry, my screen is jumping there. The Bleeding Hearts will always stick up for the nasty elements, never thinking of the victims of the crime. Gary's good intentions, yes, but he's making the mistake of thinking the type of person who carries a knife also cares about anybody. There are knife bins all over the UK, and knife crime has only increased. It certainly hasn't worked in England, whatever about Glasgow. A 10-minute interview without a single mention of the victims, the majority of citizens who can function without terrorising their fellow citizens. If you don't want to end up in jail complaining about the conditions, then do not do the crime. Another one says, knife bins aren't a bad idea, but we also need an intimidating CRS-style police presence in the city centre and more liberal, or illiberal perhaps, stop and search laws. That's from Ed. Now, in a...
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.